hadn't managed to get in touch with him by 4, I'd come by to wait for him. When I finished, Christian was regarding me warily.
"You let him do that to you? Push you around like that? Force answers from you?"
The tiger gold gaze swept me up and down. The handsome face tightened.
"I thought you were a different kind of girl."
"I am a different kind of girl. Or at least I had been when I first came to Dublin. I wasn't sure what kind of girl I was now, but I hated the look in his eyes. Aloofness, censure, disappointment. He's never done it before. We have a complicated association."
"Doesn't sound like an association to me. Sounds like a tyranny."
I wasn't about to discuss the complexities of life with barons, with anyone, especially not a living, breathing polygraph test. "He's trying to teach me to resist voice."
"Guess you aren't very good at it. And good luck. Voice is a skill that can take a lifetime to learn."
"Look, you guys were planning to talk to him anyway. I'm sorry, okay?" He measured me.
"Make up for it, then. Talk to him for us. Tell him what we want."
"I don't think you can trust him."
"I don't either. I told my uncles that. They overruled me. The problem is we aren't sure we can keep the walls up, even with Baron's help."
He paused, then said grimly,
"But we know we can't without him."
He opened a notepad, tore off a scrap of paper, wrote on it, and handed it to me.
"Here's where you can reach me."
"Where are you going?"
"You think barons won't be coming after me? I just wonder what's taken him this long. My uncles told me if he ever got wise to me, I should get out fast. Besides, I told her what I came back to say, and they can use me at home."
He moved toward the door, opened it, then paused and looked back at me, golden eyes troubled.
"Are you having sex with him, Mac?"
I gaped. "Barons?" He nodded.
"No."
Christian sighed and folded his arms over his chest.
"What?"
I snapped. "I've never slept with barons. Subject that to your little lie detector test. Not that I see how it's any of your concern."
"My uncles want to know exactly where you stand, Mac. A woman who's having sex with a man is a compromised source of information at best. At worst, she's a traitor. That's how it's my concern."
I thought of Alina and wanted to protest that it wasn't true, but what had she betrayed to her lover, believing them to be on the same side? "I've never had sex with barons," I told him again. "Satisfied?" His gaze was remote, a tiger assessing its prey.
"Answer one more question, and I might be. Do you want to have sex with barons?"
I gave him a hard look and stormed from the room. It was such a stupid question, and so far out of line that I refused to dignify it with a response. Halfway down the hall, I drew up short. Dad has told me all kinds of wise-sounding things over the years. I haven't understood a lot, but I filed it all away because Jack Lane doesn't waste breath, and I figured one day some of it might make sense. You can't change an unpleasant reality if you won't acknowledge it, Mac. You can only control what you're willing to face. Truth hurts, but lies can kill. We'd been having a talk about my grades again. I'd told him I didn't care if I ever graduated. It wasn't the truth. The truth was I didn't think I was very smart, and I had to work twice as hard as everyone else to get passing grades, so I'd spent most of my high school pretending not to care. I turned slowly. He was leaning in the doorway, arms folded, looking young and hot and everything a girl could want. He arched a dark brow. What a gorgeous guy. He was the one I should be thinking about having sex with. "No," I said clearly. "I don't want to have sex with Jericho Barons."
"Lie,"
Christian said. I headed back to the bookstore, flashlights on, watching everyone and everything. My brain was too stuffed with thoughts to be able to sort them out. I walked and watched, hoping my gut would piece things together into a plan of action. and notify me when it was done. I was passing the Stag's Head pub when two things occurred. The black ice of a hunter dusted me, and Inspector Jane squealed to a stop in a blue Renault, flung open the passenger door, and barked, "Get in!" I glanced up. The hunter hovered, great black wings churning ice in the night air. It terrified me in my special she-seer place. But I'd seen and done a lot since my last encounter with one of them, and I wasn't the same any more. Before it could speak in my mind, I sent it a message of my own. "You'll choke on my spear if you make one move toward me." It laughed. With a woof, woof of leathery midnight sails, it rose into the twilight and vanished. I got in the car.
"Slump!"
Jane fired at me. Raising both eyebrows, I slumped. He drove to a brightly lit back parking lot of a church. I could see the steeple from where I crouched, pulled in between cars and turned off the lights and engine. I sat up. The parking lot sure was packed for a Thursday night. "Is it some kind of religious day?"
"Stay down,"
he barked.
"I won't be seen with you."
I withdrew to the floorboards again. He stared straight ahead.
"The churches have been packed for weeks. The crime hike is scaring people."
He was silent a moment.
"So how bad is it? Should I get my family out?"
"I would, if it were my family," I said frankly.
"Where should I take them?"
I didn't know what the rest of the world out there was like in terms of Unseelie, but the Shisadu was here, an evil centrifuge distilling people to their darkest essences. "As far from Dublin as you can." He continued staring straight ahead in silence, until I began to fidget impatiently. I was getting a cramp in my leg. There was something else he wanted. I wished he'd hurry up and get to it before my foot went to sleep. Finally, he said,
"That night, that you know, I went back to the station and saw the people that I work with."
"You saw that some of the Garda are Unseelie," I said. He nodded.
"Now I can't see them anymore, but I know who they are. And I tell myself, you did something to me, somehow, and it was all a hallucination."
He rubbed his face.
"Then I see the reports coming in, and I watch what they do, or rather don't do, like investigate a bloody damn thing, and I..."
When he trailed off, I waited.
"I think they killed O'Duffy to shut him up, and tried to make it look like a human did it. Two more Garda have been killed. They had begun asking a lot of questions, and..."
He trailed off again. The silence lengthened. Abruptly, he looked straight at me. His face was red, his eyes bright and hard.
"I'd like to have tea with you again, Miss Lane."
I stared. That was the last thing I'd expected. Had I created an addict? "Why?" I said warily. Was he craving it like I was? Could he sense the tiny jars of wriggling flesh in my purse, yet to be deposited on the upper floors of the store? I could. I'd been feeling the dark pull of it beneath my arm all afternoon.
"I swore to uphold the peace in this city, and I will. But I can't this way. I'm a sitting duck,"
he said bitterly.
"You are right. I didn't know what was out there, but now I do. And I don't sleep at night anymore. And I'm angry all the time. And I'm useless. And it's more than my job to fight it. It's who I am. It's who Patty was, too. And that's why he died. His death should mean something."
"It could end up meaning your death," I said softly.
"I'll take that chance."
He didn't even know my tea would give him superpowers. He just wanted to be able to see them again. I could hardly blame him. I'd created this problem by feeding it to him in the first place. How would I feel in his shoes? I knew the answer to that, after an initial period of denial, exactly the same. Jane wasn't the ostrich I'd pegged him as, after all. "If you betray yourself, they'll kill you," I warned.
"They might kill me anyway, and I won't even see them coming."
"Some of them are pretty horrific. They can startle you into betraying yourself." He gave me a tight smile.
"Lady, you should see the crime scenes I've been on lately."
I need to think about it. Eating unseelie had many repercussions. I didn't want to be responsible for what the good inspector might become.
You're the one who opened my eyes, Miss Lane. You owe me. You get one more heads up on the house, but after the next crime it's no tea, no tips.
He dropped me a few blocks from the bookstore. The interior lights of Barron's Books and Baubles were at the closed-for-business level when I let myself in, which was enough to keep shades away, but little more. I moved to the counter, dropped my flashlights, and stripped off my jacket. There were some papers on it that hadn't been there earlier. I riffled through them. They were receipts for a backup generator, a state-of-the-art security system, and a proposal for installation. The bill was astronomical. An appointment was noted for the work to begin the first week of November. I didn't hear him behind me. I felt him. Electric. Wild. 1 foot in the swamp. Never going to crawl all the way out. And I wanted to have sex with whatever he was. Where was I supposed to put that in my head? I wadded the thought up, stuffed it in my padlocked box, and tested the chains. I was going to need a few more. I turned and we had one of those wordless conversations that were our specialty. "Nice apology," I said, "but not enough."
"It's not an apology. I don't owe you one."
Our wordless conversation ended there. We're getting worse at them. Distrust clouds my eyes, and I can't see past it.
"Do you have any news for me today, Miss Lane?"
said Barron's. I thrust my hands in my pockets. "No run-ins with the book?"
"No calls from Jane?"
I shook my head. He could voice me on that one, and I'd still be able to say no. He'd asked the wrong question. I took perverse pleasure in that.
"Any contact with Blaine?"
"Aren't you question boy tonight? Why don't you try judging my actions?" I said. "Speaking of which, I've decided I see the wisdom of your advice."
"Has hell frozen over?"
he said dryly. "Funny. I'm not going to ask you questions tonight, Barron's. I'm going to ask you for 3 actions. It seemed my gut had come up with a plan. I hoped my instincts were sound. Interest uncoiled like a dark snake in his eyes.
"Go on."
I reached beneath my jacket, removed my spear from the shoulder harness, and held it out to him. "Here, take this." Here it was, the moment of truth. So simple, so telling. Dark eyes narrowed, the snake in them moved.
"Who have you been talking to, Miss Lane?"
he said softly. "No one."
"Tell me what you're after, or I won't play your little game."
There was no room for negotiation in his voice. I shrugged. It was past time to force this confrontation. "I've heard that an unseelie can't touch a seelie hallow."
"So now I'm not eating them,"
he said, reminding me of a prior accusation I'd made against him.
"I am them? You've quite the imagination, Miss Lane."
"Just take it," I said irritably. The suspense was killing me. I knew he wouldn't, couldn't. Barron's was a gripper. That was all there was to it. Long, strong, elegant fingers closed around steel. He took the spear. Astonished, certain his features would be contorted in pain, my gaze flew to his face. There wasn't a flicker of a lash, not the smallest shift of a muscle. Nothing. If anything, he looked bored. He offered it back, satisfied. I refused to take it. Maybe if he kept holding it, something would happen. He waited. I waited. Eventually, I started to feel stupid and took the spear back. He thrust his hands in his pockets and regarded me coolly. I was deflated. Barron's wasn't unseelie. Until that moment, I hadn't realized how completely I'd made my case against him and convicted him. It explained everything. His longevity, his strength, his knowledge of the Fae, why the Shades left him alone, why Blaine feared him, why the Lord Master had walked away. All of it made sense if Barons was an Unseelie. But he wasn't. I had just proved it. And now I had to go back to square one and start trying to figure out what he was all over again.
Try not to look so disappointed. One might almost think you wanted me to be Unseelie, Miss Lane. What's your second request?
I wanted him to be something. I wanted to be able to peg him and put him somewhere and quit being torn in half, one moment believing him my avenging angel, the next certain he was the devil himself. I couldn't live like this, not knowing who to trust. Off kilter, I blurted, I want you to give me the Dajai Orb.
Why?
So I can give it to the She-Seers.
You trust them?
In this, I qualified. I believe they'll use it for the greater good.
I despise that phrase, Miss Lane. Atrocities have been committed in its name. What is the greater good but tyranny's chameleon? For eons it has changed skins to sate the current ruler's hunger for political and spiritual dominion.
He had a point there. But in this case, the greater good was my whole world, as I knew it, and I wanted to keep knowing it. I clarified. They think they can use it to reinforce the walls on Halloween.
Very well. I will bring it to you tomorrow night.
I almost fell over. Really? Two surprises. Barons wasn't Unseelie, and he'd just agreed to hand over a priceless relic, asking nothing in return. Why was he being so nice? Was this his apology for last night?
What's the third thing you want, Miss Lane?
This one was going to be a little trickier. What do you know about the walls between realms?
I know they're paper thin at the moment. I know some of the smaller, less powerful Fae have been slipping through the cracks without the Lord Master's help. The prison continues to contain the most powerful.
His comment sidetracked me. You know, that just doesn't make sense. Why are the less powerful ones able to escape? I'd think it would be the other way around.
The walls were created from a formidable magic, he said, which no Fae has been able to match since. At great cost to herself, the Queen wove living strands of the Song of Making into the walls of the prison, which slams the magic of the Unseelie back at them. The stronger the Unseelie, the stronger the wall. By attempting to break free, they actually join forces with their jailer.
Cool trick. So, do you know why the walls are so thin?
Aren't you question girl tonight?
I gave him a look. He smiled faintly.
Why are the walls so thin?
Because when the compact was struck, humans were appointed to help maintain them. But those responsible for keeping them up with their rituals, the most important of which take place every Halloween, have been attacked by dark magic each time they've performed it over the past few years. They've exhausted the limits of their knowledge and power. If it happens again this year, and there's every reason to expect it will, the walls will come down completely, even the prison walls.
What does this have to do with me, Miss Lane?
If the walls come down completely, all the Unseelie will get out, Barons.
So?
You told me once you didn't want that to happen.
Doesn't mean it's my problem.
He was looking bored again. This is the third action I want. I want you to make it your problem.
In what manner?
They think you can help them. Can you? He considered it.
Possibly.
I wanted to strangle him. Will you?
Motivate me.
If nothing else, it'll keep me safer. A safer oop detector is a happier one. Happier is more productive.
You haven't detected anything of use to me for several weeks.
You haven't asked me to, I said defensively.
There's an oop you know I want, yet you withheld information from me about it.
You have that information now. What's the problem? Had I just sounded like Blaine?
The problem is I still don't have the oop, Miss Lane.
I'm working on it. I'll be able to work faster, the safer I am. If the walls come down, every Unseelie out there will be hunting it, getting in my way.
You told me once that you didn't want more of them in your city. Was that a lie?
Point made. What do you want from me?
I want you to join them on Halloween and help them perform the ritual. And I want you to promise not to harm them. Because of the delicate way I'd shaped our conversation, it sounded as if I was asking him to help the She-Seers. He measured me a long moment, then said,
I'll swap you an action for an action. Get me within sight distance of the Shisadu, and I'll help your little friends.
Help my little friends, I countered, and I'll get you within sight distance of the Shisadu.
I have your word.
You trust my word?
You're an idealistic fool, of course.
You have my word. I deal with the problem of the promise I'd just made in the future. Right now, I needed to keep the walls up and make sure the human race had a future.
Then we have a deal. But your action doesn't hinge on the outcome of mine. I will do my best to help them with their ritual, but I can't assure you success. I know nothing of their abilities, and it's magic I've not done before.
I nodded. I accept your condition. You'll help them, and not harm them.
You trust my word?
He mocked. Of course not. You're a cynical bastard. But they seem willing to. The faint smile was back.
I'll help them and not harm them. Take a note, Miss Lane. You undermine yourself as a negotiator when you permit your opponent to see emotion. Never betray emotion to an enemy.
Is that what you are?
It's how you treat me. Be consistent and follow through on the finer nuances.
He turned away and moved toward the fire.
Who am I to assist and protect? The old witch herself?
It's not the She-Seers. He stopped and went very still.
Who is it?
The McKeltas. He was silent a long moment. Then he began to laugh. Softly.
Well played, Miss Lane.
I had a good teacher.
The best. Hop on one foot, Miss Lane.
Voice lessons had begun. I had a feeling they might be brutal tonight. Chapter 12. Even Rowena will have to believe in you then. Isn't that what you said, Cat? I did what you asked. I got the orb, and now you're telling me the old woman still won't let me into her libraries? I was so furious I nearly slammed down the phone.
She said you'll be welcome once the orb has served its purpose, and the walls are stunned and strong.
Cat had been apologizing for several minutes, but it had done nothing to defuse my temper. That's bogus, and you know it. What if the walls come down anyway? I can't help it if whatever she plans to do doesn't work. I kept my part of the bargain. On the other end of the phone line, Cat sighed.
She said I had no right to speak for her in the first place. And I'm sorry I did, Mac. I didn't intend to mislead you. Please believe that.
What else did she say? I asked tightly. She hesitated.
That we were to cease all contact with you until after Soin, and if we didn't, then we no longer had a home at the Abbey. That we could live in Dublin with you. She means it, too.
I had a momentary flash of Baron's books and baubles overrun by young She-Seers, and the look on the intensely private owner's face. A fleeting smile touched my lips before anger erased it. And what did you say?
I said I didn't think we should have to choose or shut out a sister She-Seer when times were as dangerous as these. And I didn't understand why she despised you so much. And she said, she can see moral decay as clearly as she can see the Fae, and you're...
I'm what? Cat cleared her throat.
Rotten to the core.
Unbelievable! My rate of moral decay was about as high as my tooth decay. I didn't have a single cavity. The woman hated me. She had disliked me since the first, and my visit with Blaine had only made things worse. I eyed the orb, resting on the counter in a box padded with bubble wrap.
I was glad I'd refused to turn it over until I'd secured an invitation to return to the Abbey from the Grand Mistress herself. "Then she can't have the orb," I said flatly.
"She said that's what you'd say, and that it proved her point. She said you'd choose your pride over saving our world from the Fae,"
said Cat. What a clever, manipulative old bat! She'd had decades to perfect her politics. Until a few months ago, the only politics I'd ever worried about were the two waitresses who always pretended they'd had terrible nights so they wouldn't have to tip me out, as if my flair for swift, exceptional drink-making had played no part in their financial success.
"I told her she was wrong, that you care about us and about the world. She's being unfair, Mac. We know that. But Well, we still need the orb. We may not be able to get you inside the Abbey, but
Her voice dropped to a near whisper.
"We'll help you as much as we can. Danny said she thinks she can get more pages from the book, and we might be able to slip a few others out, if you tell us what you're looking for."
My hand curled and uncurled. The spear felt heavy in my harness. "I need to know everything there is to know about the Shi Sadu. How you guys got it in the first place, how you were keeping it contained, and where. I want to know every rumor, legend, and myth that has ever been told about it."
"Those books are in the forbidden libraries. Only the Haven have access."
"Then you'll have to figure out how to break in."
"Why don't you ask, him to sift you in?"
Cat said. "I don't want to involve Blaine in this. I'd considered that already, and the mere thought of him in the same room with all those books about his race made me cringe. Arrogance alone might make him destroy them. Humans have no right to know our ways," he would sneer.
"You don't trust him?"
His name was bittersweet, invasive on my tongue. "He's Fae, Cat. He's the ultimate in self-serving. We may be after the same goal of keeping the walls up, but to him humans are just a means to an end. Besides, the entire Abbey would know we were there, and I'd be looking for a needle in a haystack without enough time and 700 she-seers closing in. It was a bad idea all the way around. Do you know who the members of the Haven are, and if any of them might be persuaded to help?"
"I doubt it. Rowena selects them for their loyalty to her. It didn't used to be that way. I heard we used to vote on the council members back in the day, but after we lost the book, things changed."
Talk about tyranny. I really wanted to know what had happened 20 years ago, how the book had been lost, who was to blame. I also need to know about the Haven's prophecy and the Five.
"I've never heard of either,"
Cat said. "See if you can dig up something. And anything about the 4 translation stones, too." I had a lot of questions I needed answered, not to mention all the ones about where I'd come from. But for now, those were going to have to wait.
"Will do. What about the orb, Mac?"
I stared broodingly at it. If I toughed it out until Halloween and refused to let Rowena have it, might she relent and share information with me? I doubted it. But even if she did, what would that accomplish? What good would information serve at such a late hour? As the old woman had said, time was of the essence. I needed information now. If the walls crashed, would the LM send every Unseelie in existence out hunting for the book? Would the streets of Dublin run so thick with dark fae that no she-seer would dare enter them, not even me? We couldn't let things get that far. The walls had to stay up. Maybe having the orb in advance would help Rowena perfect the ritual she planned to perform. Between the she-seers, barons, and the McKelters, surely they could get the ritual right one more time and buy me until next Halloween, an entire year, to figure things out. I swallowed my pride. Again. I was really beginning to resent the greater good. Besides, there was an abbey full of she-seers as worried as I was. I wanted them to know I was firmly on their side, just not their leaders. "I'll drop it by PHI sometime tomorrow, Cat," I said finally. "But you guys owe me a big one, Several big ones. And tell Rowena it's a darn good thing one of us has grown up enough to do the right thing. At 7 o'clock Saturday evening, I was sitting in the front conversation area of the bookstore, legs crossed, foot kicking air impatiently, waiting for Behrens.
"Your problem, Miss Lane,"
he'd said last night after he'd handed me the orb,
"is you're still being passive, sitting around, waiting for phone calls. Although Jane wasn't an entirely bad idea."
"Jane was a brilliant idea, and you know it."
"Time is not on our side. You must be aggressive. You promised me a sighting. I want it."
"What do you suggest?"
"Tomorrow we hunt. Sleep late. I'll be keeping you up all night."
I'd shrugged off a thrill of unwanted sexual awareness at his words. No doubt Behrens could keep a woman up all night. "Why night? Why not hunt the book during the day? Where did he go? What did he do?"
"I've been tracking crimes in the dailies. Night is its time. Has Jane ever called you during the day?"
There was that. He hadn't.
7 o'clock, Miss Lane. You'll have an hour of voice first."
I stood up, stretched, caught sight of my reflection in the window, and admired the picture. My new jeans were French and fit like a dream. My sweater was pink and soft. My boots were Dolce & Gabbana. My jacket was Andrew Mark, made of the supplest black leather I'd ever seen, and I'd woven a brilliant pink, yellow, and purple silk scarf through my hair and taken my time with my makeup. I looked and felt great. Behrens was still apologizing, or maybe just trying to get on my good side. This morning, when I'd awakened, there'd been 4 shopping totes and 2 hanging garment bags outside my bedroom door, full of new clothes. It wigged me out that Behrens had shopped for me, especially considering what was in some of those bags. The man had exceptional taste and an eye for detail. Everything fit. That wigged me out, too. The bell over the door tinkled, and Behrens stepped in. He was Knight in an Armani suit, silver-toed boots, black shirt, and dark eyes. "Not bothering with the mirror tonight?" I said breezily. "Or have you forgotten I know you walk around in it?"
"Kneel before me, Miss Lane."
His words surrounded me, infiltrated me, drove me to my knees, like a human before a fae.
"Doesn't that just burn?"
He gave me one of his scarier smiles.
"Kneeling to me must offend every ounce of your perky little being."
I'd show him perky. Jaw clenched, I tried to rise. I tried to scratch my nose. I couldn't even do that. I was as locked in place as a person in a body-encompassing straitjacket. "Why does your command lock down my whole body?" At least my vocal cords were working.
"It doesn't. My order only holds you on your knees. The rest of you is free to move. You're over-muscling yourself, struggling so hard you're locking up. When someone uses voice on you, they've got you only to the letter of their command. Remember that. Close your eyes, Miss Lane."
It wasn't an order, but I did it anyway. I managed to wiggle my fingers, then my entire hands. I poked around inside my head. The she-seer place burned hot, but everything else was dark. The she-seer place didn't have a thing to do with resisting voice.
"Who are you?"
he demanded. What an odd question. Didn't he know everything about me? I'd like to be able to voice him on that one. "I'm Mac. Michaela Lane." Perhaps O'Connor in my blood, but Lane in my heart.
"Strip away the name. Who are you?"
I shrugged. Ha! Now only my knees were rooted. The rest of me was moving freely. I swung my arms to make sure he knew it. "A girl. 22. A she-seer. A dot..."
"Labels,"
he said impatiently.
"Who the fuck are you, Miss Lane?"
I opened my eyes. "I don't get it."
"Close your eyes."
Voice ricocheted from wall to wall. My eyes closed as if they were his.
You exist only inside yourself, he said. No one sees you. You see no one. You are without censure, beyond judgment. There is no law, no right or wrong. How did you feel when you saw your sister's body?
Rage filled me. Rage at what had been done to her. Rage at him for bringing it up. The thought that no one could see or judge me was liberating. I swelled with grief and anger.
Now tell me who you are.
Vengeance, I said in a cold voice.
Better, Miss Lane. But try again. And when you speak to me, bow your head.
I was bleeding by the time the night's lesson was over. In several places. They were self-inflicted wounds. I understood why he'd done it. This was tough, well, not love, but tough life lessons. I had to learn this, and I would do whatever it took. When he'd made me pick up the knife and cut myself, I'd seen a glimmer of light in the darkness inside my skull. I'd still cut myself, but something deep inside me had stirred. It was there somewhere, if I could just dig deep enough to get to it. I wondered who I'd be by the time I got there. Was this why Barons was the way he was? Who had put Jericho Barons on his knees? I could hardly even picture it. Did you hurt yourself when you learned? I asked.
Many times.
How long did it take you? He smiled faintly.
Years.
That's unacceptable. I need this now, at least to be able to resist, or I'll never be able to get near the LM. I thought he was going to argue with me about getting near the LM, but he only said,
That's why I've been skipping years of training, taking you far ahead into difficult territory. Tonight was only the beginning of pain. If you're not okay with where it's going, tell me here and now. I won't ask again. I'll push you as far as I think you can go.
I took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. I'm okay with it.
Go bandage yourself, Miss Lane. Use this.
He withdrew a small bottle of ointment from his pocket. What is it?
It will speed the healing.
When I returned, he held open the door and ushered me into the night. I glanced instinctively to the right. My gargantuan shade was a dark cloud on top of the building next door. It loomed menacingly and began to slither down the brick facade. Barron stepped out behind me. The shade retreated. What are you? I said irritably.
In the Serengeti, Miss Lane, I would be the cheetah. I'm stronger, smarter, faster, and hungrier than everything else out there. And I don't apologize to the gazelle when I take it down.
Sighing, I moved for the bike, but he turned left. We're walking? I was surprised.
For a few hours. I want to look at the city. Then we'll come back for a car.
Unseelie were everywhere in the damp, cobbled streets. The ever-increasing crime rate didn't seem to be keeping anyone at home. The juxtaposition of the two worlds, carefree humans, some half-drunk, others only beginning their night on the town, laughing and talking, mingling with the predatory, grimly focused Unseelie draped loosely in glamour that I now had to work to see, as opposed to having to work to see past, painted the night with the slick menace of a traveling carnival. There were rhino boys and those creepy-looking street vendors with the huge eyes and no mouths. There were winged things and things that scampered. Some were in high glamour, walking down the sidewalk with human companions. Others perched on buildings, birds of prey, selecting a kill. I half expected one of them to recognize us, sound the alarm, and descend in force.
They're self-serving,
Theron said when I mentioned it.
They obey a master as long as he's in their face. But an Unseelie's true master is its hunger, and this city is a banquet. They've been trapped for hundreds of thousands of years. There is little left of them but hunger at this point. It's consuming to feel so empty, so hollow. It blinds them to all else.
I looked at him sharply. He'd sounded strange there at the end, almost as if he felt sorry for them.
When did you last kill one of them, Miss Lane?
he said suddenly. Yesterday.
Was there trouble you didn't tell me about?
No, I just cut him up for parts.
What?
Baron stopped and looked down at me. I shrugged. A woman died the other day. She wouldn't have if I'd had it handy. I won't make that mistake again. I was secure in my conviction that I was doing the right thing.
The woman in my store?
When I nodded, he said,
And just where are you keeping these parts, Miss Lane?
In my purse.
Do you think that's wise?
I think I just said I did, I said coolly.
You do realize if you eat it again, you won't be able to sense the one thing we need.
I've got it under control, Barons. I hadn't even looked at the jars since lunch.
One never has an addiction under control. If you eat it again, I will personally kick your ass. Got it?
If I eat it again, you can try to personally kick my ass. Being able to hold my own with Barons had been one of the many upsides to eating unseelie. I often craved it for that reason alone.
I'll wait till it wears off, he growled.
What fun would that be? I would never forget the night we'd fought, the unexpected lust. We looked at each other, and for a moment those clouds of distrust lifted, and I saw his thoughts in his eyes.
You were something to see, he didn't say.
You were something to feel, I didn't reply.
His gaze shuddered.
I looked away. We walked briskly down the sidewalk. Abruptly, he grabbed my arm and detoured me down a side alley. Two dark fey were doing something near a trash can. I really didn't want to know what.
Let's see how good your fighting skills are, Miss Lane, when you're not pumped up on unseelie steroids.
But before I could lose myself in the bliss of killing a few of the bastards, my cell phone rang. It was Inspector Jane. Chapter 13 The next few days settled into a strange routine and sped by with me mostly in a daze. Barons came each night and taught me voice, and each night, unable to find my backbone, I came away with fresh wounds. Then we hunted the Shisadu. Or rather, he hunted the Shisadu, and I continued taking great pains to avoid it, as I had the other night when Jane had called to tip me off, steering Barons in the opposite direction, keeping us far enough away that I wouldn't betray subtle signs of its proximity, like flailing in a puddle, clutching my head, or foaming at the mouth. At some point each day, Vlaine appeared to question me about the fruits of my labors. I made sure I had no fruits. He began bringing me gifts. One day he brought me chocolate that wouldn't make me gain weight, no matter how much I ate. Another day he brought me dusky, spicy-smelling flowers from Fairy that would bloom immortally. After he left, I threw them both out. Chocolate should make you fat, and flowers should die. Those were things you could count on. I needed things to count on. When I wasn't busy being yo-yoed back and forth between the two of them, I tended the bookstore, badgered Cat and Danny for information, and continued pushing my way through stacks of books about the Fae, having exhausted my internet search for anything of use. There was so much role-playing and fanfic online that it was impossible to distinguish fact from fiction. I was getting nowhere, a car spinning its tires in the mud, all too aware that even if I got out of the mud, I didn't know where to go. The tension and indecision in my life became unbearable. I was edgy and snapped at everyone, including my dad when he called to tell me Mom finally seemed to be getting better. They were decreasing her Valium and increasing her antidepressants. She had cooked breakfast Sunday. Cheese grits. How I missed those. Pork chops and eggs. She'd even made fresh yeast bread. I pondered that breakfast after I hung up, tried to place it somewhere in my life while I munched a power bar. Home was a gazillion miles away. Halloween was 10 days away. Soon the Sea Shears would be doing their thing at the Abbey. Barons and the McKelters would be doing theirs in Scotland. I hadn't yet decided where I would be. Barons had asked me to accompany him, no doubt to oop-detect the McKelter estate while we were there. I was considering crashing the Abbey. I wanted to be somewhere doing my part, whatever that might be, even if my part was only keeping Barons and the McKelters from killing each other. Christian had phoned yesterday to tell me things were moving ahead, but if they survived the ritual, they might not survive each other. Come All Hallows' Eve, the walls would stand or fall. Weirdly, I'd begun looking forward to Halloween, because at least my waiting would be over. Limbo would end. I'd know what I had to deal with. I'd know exactly how good or bad things were going to be. I'd know if I could be relieved. A year would buy me plenty of time to figure out what to do, or if I should be terrified. Either way, I'd have concretes. I had no concretes where the book, Beast, was concerned. I didn't know how to get it or what to do with it. I had no concretes where Barons or Blaine were concerned. I didn't trust either of them. Making matters worse, each time I glanced out the window or stepped outside, I had to battle the intense biological imperative to slay monsters, or eat them. Rhino boys were everywhere, looking absurd in city employee uniforms, stumpy arms and legs popping buttons and straining seams. I felt a constant mild nausea from their presence. Reluctant to turn my volume down again, I'd begun taking Pepcid with my morning coffee. I'd even tried switching to decaf to calm my nerves. That had been a monumental mistake. I needed my caffeine. I made it one day. Something had to give. I was a jumpy, broody, temperamental mess. I can't tell you how many times over those endless, angsty days I decided to trust Barons. Then tossed him out in favor of Blaine. I made my cases painstakingly, with lengthy lists of pros and cons neatly tabulated in my journal in three columns, tallying their good actions, bad actions, and those of indeterminate nature. The latter was by far the longest column for them both. One day I even persuaded myself to throw in the towel, give Rowena my spear, and join up with the She-Seers. There was not only safety in numbers, I could pass off the crushing responsibility of decision-making and hand it over to the Grand Mistress. If the world subsequently went to hell in a handbasket, at least I was off the hook. That was the Mac I knew. I never wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be taken care of. How had I gotten myself stuck in this mess where I was supposed to take care of everyone else? Fortunately, by the time Rowena returned my call, I was even grumpier. She was her usual pissy self. We'd swiftly gotten into one of our standoffs, and I'd come to my senses, pretending I'd only called to make sure she'd gotten the orb, since she hadn't been there when I'd dropped it by.
"If you called expecting thanks, you'll be getting none from me."
She'd snapped and hung up, reminding me of all the many reasons I couldn't stand her. Each day I made one more slash mark on my calendar, and October 31st marched closer. I remembered past Halloweens, the friends, the parties, the fun, and wondered what it would bring this year. Tricks or treats? Oh yeah, something had to give. At noon on Wednesday, I was at a spa in St. Martin, getting a massage, Blaine's latest gift from whatever human dating manual he was reading. Was it any wonder I was rapidly losing any sense of reality? Monsters and mayhem and massages, oh my. When it was over, I dressed and was escorted to a private dining room in the hotel where Blaine met me on a terrace overlooking the ocean. He pulled back a chair and seated me before a table drenched with linen, fine crystal, and finer food. Mac 1.0 would have felt many things, flattered, flirtatious, in her element. I felt hungry. I picked up a knife, stabbed a strawberry, and ate it off the blade. I might have used my spear, but, as usual, it vanished the moment he appeared. I felt more naked without it fully clothed than I did nude, and if given the choice, I would have walked through the resort bare as I'd been born, if it had meant keeping the spear. For the past few days, Blaine had been in his most human-like form when we'd met, heavily muted. He, too, was trying to get on my good side. Ironically, the more he and Barons tried, the less I trusted them both. Heads turned when the Fey Prince moved through the public places he took me. Even turned off, women stared after him with voracious eyes. I dug into the spread with gusto, piling a plate with strawberries, pineapple, lobster, crab cakes, crackers, and caviar. I'd been living on popcorn and ramen noodles too long. What exactly is the Shisadu, Blaine, and why does everyone want it? Blaine's eyelids lowered halfway, and he looked to the side. It was a human look, secretive, contemplative, as if he were sorting through a wealth of information, trying to decide how much, if anything, to share.
What do you know of it, Michaela?
Virtually nothing, I said. What's in it that everyone wants so badly? It was hard to think of it as a book with an it for information to be in, when scored into my mind was the dark shape of the beast, not pages at all.
What did it look like when you saw it? A book. Ancient and heavy, bound by bands and locks.
I nodded.
Have you seen the creature it becomes?
He absorbed my face.
I see you have. You neglected to tell me that.
I didn't think it was important.
Everything that concerns the Shisadu is important. What legends do humans tell of our origins, Shisir?
It was a sure sign he was displeased when he called me by title, not name. I told him what little I'd learned from the Irish Book of Invasions. He shook his head.
Recent history, grossly inaccurate. We have been here far longer than that. Do you know the history of the Unseelie King?
No.
Then you do not know who he is.
I shook my head. Should I?
The Unseelie King was once the King of the Light, the Queen's consort, and Seelie. In the beginning, there was only Seelie.
He had me. I was riveted. This was true Fey lore straight from a Fey. Stuff I doubted I'd ever find in the Shisir archives. What happened?
What happened in your Eden?
He mocked.
What always happens? Someone wanted more.
The king? I guessed.
Ours is a matriarchal line. The king held vestigial power. Only the queen knew the song of making.
What's the song of making? I'd heard of it from barons and seen references in the books I'd been reading, but still didn't know what it was.
Impossible to explain to your stunted consciousness.
Try, I said dryly. He gave me one of his affected shrugs.
It is life. It is that from which we come. It is the ultimate power to create, to destroy, depending on how it is used. It sings into existence. Change.
As opposed to stasis.
Exactly,
he said, then his eyes narrowed.
You mock me.
Only a little. Do Fey really only understand those two things? A sudden, icy breeze buffeted the terrace and tiny crystals of frost settled over my plate.
Our perception is not limited, Shisir. It is so vast it defies your paltry language, as does my name. It is because we comprehend so much that we must distill things to their essential natures. Do not presume to think you understand our nature. Though we have long consorted with your race, we have never shown our true face. It is impossible for you to truly behold us. If I showed you...
He stopped abruptly. Showed me what, Blaine? I said softly. I popped a bite of cracker spread with lightly frosted caviar in my mouth. I'd never had it before.
I wouldn't be having it again. Rhino Boy was more palatable.
I hastily downed a strawberry chased by a gulp of champagne. He offered me a smile. He'd been practicing. It was smoother, less alien. The day heated up again, the frost melted.
Irrelevant. You wanted to know of our origins.
I wanted to know about the book, but I was eager to hear anything else he was willing to share. How do you know the history of your race, if you've drunk from the cauldron?
We have stores of knowledge.
After drinking, most seek immediately to become reacquainted with who and what we are.
You forget to remember. How strange. And how awful, I thought, to be so paranoid, to have lived so long madness settled in, to be reborn but never truly wiped clean, to come back fearful, in a place of such strange and treacherous politics. The Seelie King wanted more, I prompted.
Yes, he envied the Queen the Song of Making, and petitioned her to teach it to him. He had become enamored of a mortal of whom he did not wish to be deprived, until he had sated his desire for her. It did not appear to be waning. She was different to him. I would merely have substituted another. He asked the Queen to make her fae.
Can the Queen do that? Make someone fae?
I do not know. The King believed she could. The Queen refused, and the King tried to steal from her that which he sought. When she caught him, she punished him. Then she waited for his obsession to pale. It did not. He began experimenting on lesser fae, in hopes of teaching himself the song.
What kind of experiments?
A human might grasp it as an advanced form of genetic mutation or cloning, without DNA or physical matter to mutate. He tried to create life, Michaela. And he succeeded. But without the Song of Making.
But I thought the song is life. How could he create life without the song?
Precisely. It was imperfect. Flawed.
He paused.
Yet it lived and was immortal.
I got it and gasped. He made the Unseelie.
Yes. The Dark Ones are the Seelie King's children. For thousands of years he experimented, concealing his work from the Queen. Their numbers grew, as did their hungers.
But his mortal woman must have been long dead by then. What was the point?
She was alive, kept so in a cage of his making. But trapped, she withered. So for her, he created the sifting silvers and gave her worlds to explore. Although time passes outside them, within them it does not. One might spend 1,000 centuries in there and walk out not 1 hour older.
I thought the mirrors were used for travel between realms.
They are used for that, too. The silvers are complicated things, doubly so, since they were cursed. When the Queen felt the power of the silvers spring into existence, she called the King to court and demanded he destroy them. Creation was her right, not his. In truth, she was disturbed to discover he had grown so powerful. He claimed to have made them as a gift for her, which pleased her, as he had paid her no tribute in eons. But the King gave her only a portion of the silvers. The others he kept hidden from her, for his concubine, where he planted lush gardens and built a great shining white house upon a hill, with hundreds of windows and thousands of rooms. When his mortal grew restless, he made her the amulet, so she could shape reality with her will. When she complained of loneliness, he made her the box.
What does it do?
I do not know. It has not been seen since.
Are you saying he also made her the book? But why?
Patience, human. I tell this tale. The King's experiments continued. Eons passed. He created more aberrations. Over time, of which we have a fortunate abundance, they began to improve, until some of them were as beautiful as any Seelie. The Unseelie royalty were born, the princes and princesses, dark counterparts to the light. And like their counterparts, they wanted what was rightfully theirs, power, freedom to come and go, dominion over lesser beings. The King refused. Secrecy was a necessary part of his plan.
But someone went to the Queen, I guessed. One of the Unseelie.
Yes. When she learned of his treachery, she tried to strip him of his power, but he had grown too strong, and learned too much.
Not the song, but another melody, a darker one. They battled fiercely, sending their armies against each other. Thousands of Fae died. In that age, we still had many weapons, not merely the few that remain. Fairy withered and blackened, the skies ran with the lifeblood of our kind. The planet itself upon which we lived wept to see our shame, and cracked from end to end. And still they fought, until he took up the sword, and she took up the spear, and the king killed the fairy queen.
I inhaled sharply. The queen is dead?
And the song died with her. She was slain before she was able to name her successor and pass on her essence. When she died, the king and all the Unseelie vanished. Before dying, she had managed to complete the walls of the prison, and with her last breath uttered the spell to contain them. Those Unseelie that eluded the spell's radius were hunted by the Seelie and killed.
So where does the book come into all this?
The book was never meant to be what it was. It was created in an act of atonement.
Atonement? I echoed. You mean for killing the queen?
No. The king's atonement was to his concubine. She slipped from the silvers and took her own life. She hated what the king had become so much that she left him the only way she could.
I shivered, chilled by the dark tale.
They say the king went mad, and when his madness finally abated, he beheld the dark kingdom he had created with horror. In her name, he vowed to change, to become the leader of his race. But he knew too much. Knowledge is power. Immense knowledge is immense power. So long as he had it, his race would never trust him. Aware they would not let him near the cauldron of forgetting, and even if they did, they would destroy him the second he drank from it. He created a mystical book into which to pour all his dark knowledge. Freed of it, he would banish it to another realm where it could never be found and used for harm. He would return to his people, their Seelie king, beg their forgiveness, and lead them into a new age. The Fae would become patriarchal. The Unseelie, of course, would be left to rot in their prison.
So that's what the book is, I exclaimed. Part of the Dark King himself. The worst part.
Over the eons it changed, as Fae things do, and became a living thing, far different from what it was when the king created it.
Why didn't the king destroy it?
He had made, how do you say it, his doppelganger. It was his equal, and he could not defeat it. He feared one day it might defeat him. He cast it out, and for much time it was lost.
I wondered how it had come to be in the She-Seer's care. I didn't ask, because if Lane didn't know it had been there, I didn't want to be the one to tell him. He despised Rowena, and might decide to punish her, and other She-Seers could suffer in the process. Why does the queen want it? Wait a minute. If the queen is dead, who is Avil?
One of the many who came after, and tried to lead our race. She wants it because it is believed that somewhere in all its darkness, the book contains the key to the true song of making that has been lost to my race for 700,000 years. The king was close, very close. And only with living strands of that song can the Unseelie be re-imprisoned.
And Darok? Why does he want it?
He thinks foolishly to possess its power.
Barons?
The same.
Am I supposed to believe you're different? That you would blithely hand all that power to the queen with no thought for yourself? Sarcasm laced my words. Vlaine and self-serving were synonyms.
You forget something, Michaela. I am Seelie. I cannot touch the book. But she can. The queen and king are the only two of our race that can touch all the hallows, Seelie and Unseelie. You must obtain it. Summon me, and I will escort you to her. We alone have any hope of rebuilding the walls, should they come down. Not the old woman, nor Darok, nor barons. You must place your trust, as I have, in the queen.
It was dark when I returned, massaged, manicured, pedicured, and waxed. There were a dozen long-stemmed red roses wrapped in tissue paper waiting for me, propped in the alcoved entrance to the bookstore. I bent to pick them up, then stood in the lighted cubby, fumbling with the card. "Help me find it, and I will give you your sister back. Refuse, and I will take what you prize most."